Geeks are so hot.
He's got so much muscle. He's got so much brawn. He's got brains, he's got money. Some people have it all. There's something that I wouldn't know about.
Okay, so this is David Starr, and this weekend, as well as many weeks into the future, I hope we're going to be joined by Chris Bransma. Howdy, Chris.
Hello, David. How you doing today?
I thought I was in the need of a co-host here on the Elegant Codecast, and I really thought that what I needed was a comic relief, you know, like Ed McMahon or something. But Chris,
No, I thought I was a straight man.
Right. So Chris has been kind enough to inform me that what I really need is a straight man, right?
I'm trying to think of how we could fit this in with Laurel and Hardy myself.
You know, skinny man, fat man, always funny.
You got it.
It's like big man, little car. Never gets old. Well, I'm really excited because this week we get to talk to Mark Miller, C-Sharp MVP and all-around great guy. I've known him since I met him at the Boise Code Camp. You were there for that. And you've known him longer than that, I believe, right?
You know, I've met him many times. I met him at the MVP Summit in 06. Talked with him there because he was a C-Sharp MVP, and I just happened to be there for the party. It was kind of an odd thing.
Mark is actually a fellow Idahoan, that's the word that we use. We live in Idaho. And the difference is he lives in the northern half of the state up near Spokane, Washington, whereas Chris and I live in Boise. So
down in the southwest.
Yeah, we'll get to Mark here in a few minutes, but first we've been having a recurring feature here on the Elegant Codecast talking about agility, different aspects of agile software development, and I'm taking a risk with this one. I haven't told Chris this story yet, but here we go, Chris. I have a friend who is a pastor at a church here in Boise, and one day we were talking about Scrum, and I was trying to talk to him about what this Scrum thing is. And I also mentioned that I was quite frustrated with the fact that there were a lot of people out there who seemed to be Scrum-ish, right? And if you ask them, yeah, I'm doing Scrum. Or if you ask them if they're agile, they'll say, yeah, we're doing Scrum. And then they'll tell you all these ways in which they're violating all the rules of Scrum, right? So my friend says, oh, you mean like prayer? I said, what do you mean like prayer? He says, well, it's like this. Every time somebody tells me I've been praying for you, I respond with, to who and how? And I said, you've got to be kidding. Why would you ask a question like that? He said, because there's a way to do this, right? There's all this literature, there's all this evidence and thinking and history that tells us this is how you do this thing. And there's sort of, if you will, prescriptive guidance. And if you're, you know, just kind of riding your bike down the street thinking good thoughts about Mark, or I shouldn't have said his name, thinking good thoughts about me, then just tell me that, right? Just tell me, yeah, I've been thinking good thoughts about you. But don't tell me you've been praying for me, because praying's this whole other thing. And it really struck me, you know, that was a pretty darn good analogy for what I get really frustrated with when talking with folks about their, quote, Scrum implementation, which really means that they get together once a day and drink coffee while bitching about what happened yesterday. There's a very specific framework that's laid out for Scrum, and they do a good job of teaching that in Certified Scrum Master Training courses, and also it's laid out pretty clearly in Ken Schwaber's books on Scrum.
Yep.
Agile Project Management.
But how many people actually read those or go to those things? So you get a lot of people that hear Scrum secondhand, and that's what they're dealing with.
So does this ring a bell for you, Chris? I mean, or does it resonate with you? Or do you run into this?
Oh, yeah.
You're a consultant, and you're out there meeting with a lot of different clients. So
I mean, it totally resonates with me because, you know, what do I hear all the time? But sure, I'll hear somebody, guys, are going to say, oh, yeah, we have a morning Scrum. It lasts about an hour and a half. And the first thing I'll ask is everybody standing up during this? Oh, no, we don't do that. We didn't think it was important.
Okay.
So, like, no, you need to start doing this. You know, is this one person going on? How structured are you keeping this thing? That's really what it kind of comes down to. You have some, the guys who are in charge aren't approaching Scrum in a structured way. And so they're kind of going off any way they want because one developer doesn't like one thing, another guy doesn't like something else, and they just kind of invent their own thing as they go, and before you know it, they've got a mess, which is very indicative of the software they write as well a lot of times.
Whoa, easy. So I'm bringing this up simply because I sort of want to register the idea with folks that if you're doing Scrum or you feel like you're doing Scrum, you think you're doing Scrum and you're not sure, or in particular, if you think you're doing Scrum and it's not working for you, you're finding yourself continuously frustrated, right? Because things don't seem to be working the way all these Scrum guys promised me it would. Things still stink. My guess is you might want to spend some time taking a look at the prescriptive guidance of how Scrum really works. And what I like to tell clients is to implement the recipe, right out of the box for 3 iterations minimally, 3 months optimally, before you choose to change it. The reason for that is because everyone feels they're different, right? When I start looking at this, these prescriptive guidance packages or prescriptive guidance documents from other folks on process, everybody's first thought is, well, you know, that doesn't apply to us. We're different than that, and here's why. And the real truth of the matter is, you know what? We're not all that different. I have found that if we just give it a chance, and that means starting with an actual backlog. That's my favorite. Actually, we're doing Scrum. Oh, there's no backlog. Well, so there's a lot to that. And if you just give it a try, prep everybody up and do it, then we can make intelligent decisions about what to modify for our environment later. So that's the whole Agile rant for the day.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, so this is David Starr with the Elegant Codecast here with Chris Bransma. How you doing, Chris?
Hello.
And
hello, David.
This week we're talking with Mark Miller of DevExpress. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm good, David. And Chris, it's great to be here with you guys.
You know, it's almost goes without saying who you are. You know, I don't even feel compelled to introduce you, Mark. I think everybody in the software development industry has come across your name at some point. But as I read through some bio material for you, one of the things that I was really intrigued with was the fact that you created a motion control system for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on the stage show.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that like Robotron Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Is that what that is?
Kind of. I guess you'd say so. The essence of it was we had these actors that were wearing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle costumes, and that included a head piece mask that was created by a special effects shop that went over their heads, and inside the mask were 16 motors that controlled the lips, the jaw, the eyes, the eyebrows, and then what I created with my partner at the time, this was just out of college for me, and we created this system to allow us to synchronize the motions of these masks that the actors would wear on stage, and keep those in sync with the soundtrack from the stage show. One of the things is being kids, we were kind of irreverent, and so our primary device was called the Idiot 2000, and the Idiot was an acronym for input or interactive digital input output transmitter. And but mainly it was just, you know, so we could call it Idiot and have a phrase that says, you know, when you're working with an idiot.
Well, Mark, you qualified all of that with because we were young kids. And I got to tell you, I don't know if you've looked lately, but you're still pretty irreverent, Mark.
Yeah, I guess. But I'll tell you a couple other things that we did that I kind of would pause at a bit now. So yeah, another thing we did is we wore white lab coats because we thought it was fun to do that. You know, so think about it. You know, at a stage show, you're there at Radio City Music Hall, you're surrounded by roadies and everybody else, and then you're wearing white lab coats just to be a jerk about the whole thing. And then the other thing we did that was kind of crazy was on the side of all our boxes, we put our company slogan, which was, we don't fuck up like we used to.
That really does set the tone of success for an organization. I will never see an amusement park furry without thinking about you again.
Okay. Well, it's got to be moving, though, right? You know, I think the same thing, though. But yeah, it's got to be to have that motion. But it's, but yeah, that was very, very cool to be able to do that right out of college, right? To essentially start your own company and get, you know, out of the gate, get a job, and you know, get money to make it all work. And so that was kind of fun and exciting.
Let me ask you a question about something a little more current in your life. So every time I've seen you for the past year, you've actually been cursing your laptop. So I wonder if you could, how's that Alienware laptop working out for you, buddy?
Yeah, it still kind of sucks. I have, you know, in my cell phone, I have a collection of all the blue screens that I've had on it. You know, normally folks take pictures of their family members. I just take pictures of my blue screens. And yeah, it's kind of on its last leg, and it's almost now becoming a point of pride for me. But like right now, I have it propped up off the ground because if it's too close to the ground, it'll shut down on us. And yeah, I really wish I hadn't brought this up. It's kind of a sore topic.
All right. Well, I don't have to bring it up anymore.
Yeah. Well, I can sort of relate to that one. I actually had a blue screen while I was doing a presentation in front of 500 people once.
Okay. I was just going to say that I've experienced that exact same thing. 5 minutes in, blue screen, and had to reboot. And then I think it was, maybe no, it wasn't. It wasn't in Boise. I was thinking that I know I had trouble hooking up to at least one, but there was another conference I was at. I think it was Dev Connections, where just midway through, the machine just got too hot, shut down, and refused to start up again. And I had to borrow somebody's machine to finish the presentation. I had a backup of slides on a memory stick and was able to copy that across, fortunately. But,
yep.
You know, yeah, I'm looking forward to my next computer. I'm not sure when I'm going to get it, but I'm looking forward to it. So, like, one of my things is, like, good user interface, good user experience. And my obsession with it goes outside of just software. Like, as an example, if you know, I was staying in a hotel and I was looking at the up and down buttons for the, you know, I was staying up on, like, you know, a high floor, like the 20th floor. And I was looking at the up and down buttons, and it struck me that the down button needs to be a lot bigger than the up button, because the down button is the button you almost always press when you're on the higher floors. And likewise, when you get in, the lobby button should be a lot bigger than all the other ones. It should just be bigger. It'd be so much easier. If that was like a standard across the board, it'd be so much easier to get where you want to go, because those are the things you do more frequently. So anyway, yeah.
You're saying the two most common destinations in the elevator are going to be the lobby and where?
Well, and down. Like if I'm standing outside, if I'm on the 20th floor trying to call an elevator, how many times am I going to want to go up, and how many times do I want to go down? Right? If you just took stats on that, I just know you would get, you know, you get like 10-to-1 ratios, and the farther you are away from the bottom floor, the higher that ratio is going to be. In terms of which direction do you want to go. So based on that, I think that it seems to be reasonable that the down button should be larger. And definitely when I step into the elevator, the button for the lobby button should be bigger. I'd have it like be twice as big as everything else.
So I want to pursue this a little bit. Mark, you've had great success with a talk that you give called Science of a Great UI, User Interface. And that's been a very popular session wherever you've given it. So what's the science behind exactly what you're talking about? Because here's my take on standing outside the elevator on the 20th floor. Why not just make both the buttons bigger? What's the difference?
Yeah, you know, that works. That also is okay too, right? Because it they're easier to hit. In fact, I would actually say making both the buttons bigger is a great idea anyway. Because one of the so you asked a question, what's the deal and the science behind it, but where you also gave an example. With that example, one of the specific aspects of that science is precision. The more precision you have to exercise, the more brain power you have to exercise, right? And the greater the chance for a mistake. So this, in other words, the smaller that button. Imagine that button as big as your fingertip, right? And imagine what a pain in the butt that would be to go hone in on that button and hit it, and then compare that with a button that's as big as the palm of your hand. And imagine how easy that would be to go slap that, right?
Okay.
So, you know, so we're talking about precision. But to answer your specific question, what is really about the science in the whole, behind the whole thing is really about economics. The economics of efficiency is really what it's all about. And I've never written this down or said this anywhere before, but I'm just now, this is the first time you're getting it here in your podcast. But that's the essence of what this is all about. So when I say the economics of efficiency, what I mean by that is, I mean, how easy is it to do something? And easy is measured in terms of movement. How much motion does the person have to do? Like if we're talking about interacting with a keyboard, how many keys do I have to press? If we're talking about precision with that keyboard, and I have to do like a shift key, like to do an uppercase letter for the beginning of a word, and then I've got to release that shift key before I hit that second letter, or else I'll get two uppercase letters in a row. That's like a sense of precision there. If we're talking about moving the mouse, then we're talking about how far do I move it, how many clicks, right? Because we're talking about how much, essentially how much muscle motion, right? In that, those terms of interaction. If we're talking about where I'm looking on screen, how much are my eyes moving and having to move back and forth? If we're talking about trying to understand something or learn something, it's how efficiently can I do it? How little brain power can I exert to understand or to affect my will?
So, Mark, I'm really compelled to ask you then, the guy who thinks about this stuff more than probably any of us, okay, so what keyboard do you use? You know, that's a question. And do you spend a lot of time thinking about input devices for computers? Because, you know, we're still stuck on QWERTY keyboards. And I've paid some attention to what's coming out of the MIT Media Lab in terms of alternative input devices. And have you played with any of that stuff? Do you find it compelling?
No, not really. I haven't seen any of the new stuff. I use a Microsoft Natural Keyboard. I can only really work on natural keyboards, and they've got to have the cursor keys in that inverted T layout. That's also very important to me. Every once in a while I think about it. I do understand the inherent inefficiency of the QWERTY keyboard. If you look at the historical, explanations for why it exists the way it does, it pretty much is designed to slow you down because the old typewriters that these were all based on would jam if you were going too fast.
Right.
So that's that's the heritage. Unfortunately, I'm like really I've grown to learn to use this, and I'm very fast with it. Although I do know one of the guys on our team does use a Dvorak keyboard layout. With regard to alternate inputs, the only thing that I've been really looking at is gaze recognition systems that can tell where your eyes are looking. That's about the only thing that I've been doing a lot of research in. I haven't been doing anything on alternate inputs, but well, unless you want to count voice input as an alternate input mechanism as well.
Are you using the gaze tracking for user testing?
Not yet. Here's gaze tracking is, and actually every time it's good that I'm glad we kind of talked about this because there's a little clue that the folks that are doing voice recognition haven't maybe figured out yet. And that is that gaze tracking is the key to getting a contextual understanding. So if you're doing anything with voice recognition, and you're kind of, wanting it to be, you're wanting to improve the accuracy, I think gaze tracking can go in and fill that in a number of applications. Imagine instead of navigating and editing text, whatever, the way we do now with voice recognition, instead imagine being able to look somewhere and say, cut that, select that, or take that sentence out. Wherever you're looking, or for example, close that window, and it's wherever you're looking, it knows what you're talking about. Or get that, focus this. So gaze combined with voice recognition, I think, has it offers an opportunity to increase the accuracy of the voice recognition because it provides a context that otherwise is hard to determine. Aside from that, I haven't done any of that in user testing, gaze tracking and user testing. I haven't done that, but I do envision a future where the ability to accurately track gaze in a passive manner, in other words, from like a webcam, the webcam simply looking at your face and software is determining where you're looking at within like a 1-degree cone of accuracy, if we can get to that level of accuracy, I think we can, like, in the next 10 years. And in fact, I think we can do that, like, in the next maybe 6 years, and then give that another 4 to 8 years after that, and to bring it in as something standard in the operating system, where just like, you know, mouse support is standard in the operating system, gaze tracking is standard in the operating system. And once you get to that level, you get kind of a nice, you get this ability to have a greater amount of context. If I know where you're looking, I can change my user experience to you to be a little bit more appropriate. Like if I need you to look in another location, I can have an animation that's a little bit more, that takes you from where you're looking over to the new place where I want you to look on the screen.
Kind of like a glowing orb on top of Excel.
Yeah, I guess so. That, yeah, the glowing orb. So did I tell you that story, Chris? Is that why you're saying that?
You remember, well, yeah, that's part of your science of a great UI.
Yeah, I tell that sometimes when I do that session. Yeah, the I guess I should say it now since you brought it up. I installed Microsoft Office 2007, and for 3 days I was like, what is this glowing orb in the upper left corner? You know, it was just driving me crazy. I was just thinking it was and this is probably not the best term I use, but I call this like visual masturbation. But basically the idea that the coder is, you know, the programmer is doing something that, you know, pleases himself but nobody else, essentially. And that's kind of what I was thinking was going on with this glowing orb. And, you know, like it seemed to have no explanation. And meanwhile, I couldn't figure out where my print menu item had gone and those kinds of things. And finally, on the third day, I hovered the mouse over it, and I got that hint that says, you know, this is the Office button. Click here to open, save, or print. And I felt like pretty foolish at that moment, right, that it took me so long to find this. But this is like an example of, well, it's a great example of two things. One is, ultimately, I like this button because it's much more efficient than the old way of doing things. And it's bigger. It's bigger and easier to hit than the old file menu was. So I like that. So it drops my precision requirements down. I don't have to be so precise with it. I like that. So it's more efficient. But at what cost? Well, the cost was discoverability, right? And so to solve the discoverability problem, right, because it was hard to discover, what they did is somebody said, let's make it glow. So it actually turns out the glowing, you know, served a purpose. Unfortunately for me, I didn't think the glow meant hover. I thought the glow, I just assumed it was something else. And so that was like obviously my fault there. I should have hovered over it to find out what it meant.
You guys at Developer Express have been doing some things particularly focused on improving the discoverability of functionality within your UI components. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, not only inside of our, my team works on Refactor and CodeRush. We've been doing a lot of stuff there in terms of discoverability for many years. Since like about 2005, we had some really cool, innovative stuff. But recently, we've been kind of taking that knowledge of how important discoverability is, and maybe I'll speak to that in a second. But we've been taking that knowledge and applying it to our controls. In fact, let me just explain why discoverability is so important. There's a direct link between discoverability and your income, either your company's income, and if it's your work for a company, you know, that should be somehow translated into your income as well. The more discoverable that your features are, the more your customers will use your features. The more your customers use your features, the more satisfaction they have, and the less likely they are to go to a competing product. In other words, their loyalty increases as well. Satisfaction and loyalty lead to repeat, you know, lead to upgrades. Okay? Imagine, you know, the opposite of that, where you have no discoverability, you work your heart out on a feature and nobody uses it. And then your competitors, your competition, release a feature that's half as good as yours, but it's twice as easy to discover. And so all of your competitors' customers are enthusiastic about the feature, while your customers are not, because they don't know it exists. So there's a direct link. Discoverability is incredibly, incredibly important. What we're looking at is, how do we teach our customers about the features that we put in our controls? How do we make that super easy for them to get to that information, to see the demos, that sort of thing, to cut down the amount of steps that it's required, that it takes to learn? And as with just about any problem that is, you know, at first seems to be a challenging problem to solve, you can solve it in pieces where maybe the first thing you do is the smallest amount of effort, but it gives you a big chunk, you solve a big chunk percentage of the problem. And then the next thing you do, maybe a little more work service, and you get a little bit of a return back on that. And you keep iterating on this until you get to the point where you're solving like 99% of the problem. So we're like at the beginning phases of this, and we're just starting to do this with our controls now. And one of the things that we looked at is like, how long does it take to get to like a demo, a sample showing the product? And right now it's a lot of steps. You have to go into the start menu. You have to go, you know, find the Dev Express submenu, go find the control, then go to the demo folder, then pick your language, C# or VB, then select the demo you want, right? Something like that. Or you launch another product called Demo Center, and then you do a similar kind of navigation step. All told, it's like 10 clicks and a lot of looking and brain power. What we're doing with the next set of controls is we're giving you access to the demos and access to other features directly from the controls inside of the designer. So inside the design time environment, right? Say you drop our extra pivot grid down on top of there, and you want to see a demo of the extra pivot grid. You just click on the smart tag menu on the design surface, right? On the form, you click on the smart tag menu for that control, choose demo center or demo whatever the menu item is that we're going to call it. I think it's going to be called demo center, and it's going to start up demo center. It's going to navigate to the pivot grid demos. And it's going to take you right there, so it just cuts those 12 steps out of the way. And there's another menu item there called support, probably support center or something like that. And when you click on that, you're going to go right to our website, and it's going to filter out. Oh, one other thing, when you go and bring up the demo source code, it's going to see what language you already have working in Visual Studio. So if you're working in the C#, it'll open up the C# demo files. If you're working in VB, it'll open up the VB demo files, right?
So context sensitivity.
Yeah, exactly. So we take out like 12, 13 steps and we put it right there, and we're going to start telling people about this. So we have a feature that improves discoverability of the product, but we still have to tell people that the feature is there, right? Click the smart tag to bring the menus up. So we're going to change our install. So at the end of the install, so the last picture on the install says, here's, if you need any help, click the smart tag, click one of these two menu items and you can get right to it. This first thing with these menu items, this is kind of a baby step for us. But we have a larger map filled out in terms of how we're going to improve discoverability, how we're going to make it easier for people to learn. The goal is what we're going to try to emulate with software. The ultimate goal is to be able to have an experience for the customer that's the equivalent of sitting down with the project lead for that particular product and have the project lead take them through and show them how to do what they need to do. And even be able to say, well, here, I see what you're doing here. Here's a faster, easier way to do it. Things like that. That's the ultimate goal. We're not there yet, and it's not like we're throwing all our resources at this either, right? We're still building features and things like that. But over time, I think you're going to see the discoverability and in general the user experience of our controls. I think it's going to really set the example for how other controls are going to follow that too in terms of improving discoverability. And the other thing I might add too is that I think that to some degree that experience will hopefully, you know, filter out into developers that are writing their own applications, and they'll get a sense that, you know what, discoverability is important. It's my job. Well, maybe not my job, but it's in my best financial interest to help my customers understand how to get to the features I'm writing for them, how to use those features.
I was going to say that kind of gets into something that I've seen as well. It's you know, you talk about usability and you're talking about vision control and things like that. It seems like a lot of these things our customers are asking for, but at the same time, we're the last ones to get it in our own tools. If you start looking at Visual Studio, it's an insanely complex piece of software that you do a very good job of extending, but there's a lot of stuff that it almost seems like we're missing that at the same time we have to produce.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree with that on a couple levels. One, within the environment itself. I mean, you know, you look at the simple example that, you know, as developers, we've been working in source code, you know, text files for, you know, probably 30 years now, and the only major advance in that time period for the most part is syntax highlighting in terms of, you know, what you know, how is our file format certainly hasn't changed overall. Well, yeah, you could say that, but to some degree, it's IntelliSense doesn't change the document itself, right? The way the document looks. Syntax highlighting does, but if I wanted to stick a bitmap in, or if I wanted to put in, you know, make a bold statement in my comments, I can't do that, right? It's all still text right now. If I wanted to see my XML.doc comments and edit them in a WYSIWYG manner, I cannot do that now because we're still working in text files. So when you talk about that, seems like we're the last to get the advance. I would agree with that. You know, every other major application type out there, from spreadsheets to word processors, have seen major advances to their file formats over the years. Developers don't see that. So that's one level in which we're kind of the last to get these things. On another level, if you're just creating an application and you want to add discoverability, well, how do you do that? You use things like pop-up hints and things that, like, you know, arrows or marking up the text, whatever it is, you know, with however you're going to do that, highlighting things. You do use all kinds of things that don't really exist yet in terms of third-party controls, right? It's hard to get, like, some good, you know, good pop-up bubble hints that are out there. You pretty much have to roll your own every single time you want to do this discoverability. And as a result, right, it's one of the last things we think about. But it is important. You know, I'm not sure if DevExpress is going to do this, but I've pitched this idea in the past, but at this point I don't know if we're going to do this, but I pitched the idea for a set of controls that are essentially for improving discoverability.
In my applications.
In your applications, right. So that would include like a tip of the day control. Right, so you could put a tip of the day in there, like some really cool stuff there. So, and different kinds of kind of pop up hints and ways of communicating to the user that don't require a modal dialog box. You know, don't require a lot of extra clicks. You know, things that can go away, and maybe things that come up and say, here's the shortcuts that are available now, that sort of thing. So those are, you know, that's kind of, you know, for our stuff, we did a lot of this stuff, rolling your own stuff, with Refactor and with CodeRush, and it seems to me that we might be approaching a time period where demand for discoverability controls is going to increase to the point where it'll be worth it to create a product based on that.
I see that and feedback controls as well. I mean, when I'm looking at writing my own applications, you know, things like an error handling dialog. We don't have one. We have to roll our own every single time. What do you do with it afterwards? Well, you want to report that. There's all sorts of things like that. They're kind of one-offs as well.
Yeah, I know. And it's the thing is that everybody's got to write them, you know? And so, you know, I think the thing is that, you know, the ultimately the market economy is going to dictate what control sets we build, and, you know, and which is essentially a reflection of demand. So, you see, you know, a lot of effort being put into the things that everybody wants, like the grids, right? The grid control is like one of the, you know, the big sellers in charting and reporting, things like that. And then you go to, you know, you start focusing on the smaller, lower demand items like wizards and you know, maybe discoverability has a place in this market. You know, I'm not sure, but it's certainly, I know it's super important. And right now, everybody's got to roll their own for the most part.
Yeah, well, I can speak really, really briefly to that. I mean, I'm working on an application, and one of the things we had for discoverability that we had to do actually led us to buying Developer Express's ribbon control specifically, because a standard menu just is not discoverable. It's just like you said. And and actually, when you're talking with the UI, some of the wizards you have are actually really good in those. But I definitely like your idea of building in some of those samples and being able to link directly to them from those.
Yeah, I like that too, and I think to some degree as well. Now, and I guess related to this, this is kind of in the area of, I guess, quality control. But one of the things that we've been talking about on the IDE team is the ability for customers to report bugs more easily. And at first we were thinking just for our own product bugs, right, to get us, you know, and so what, say for example, you're working with like our products inside Visual Studio, and you encounter what you believe is a bug, the idea is that you can go into our menu, choose report issue, and then you have a bunch of checkboxes that allow you to specify what aspects of the environment you're going to send up to us so we can duplicate the bug. Including in those could be things like, if you were at a breakpoint while debugging, could be like the call stack from the debugger and maybe the threads output window and the locals window, those kinds of things. If you weren't, if you're just using the product, it could be something like, well, give me my undo redo stack. And if you give us that undo redo stack, then we have a sense of what happened just leading up to it. So you don't have to really say, here's what happened. The point behind this is so that we can increase the number of bugs that are reported to us so that we can get better reproduction on the bugs. But as we were talking about this, we realized that one thing that I just talked about, if you're at a breakpoint and being able to send that data very quickly, like to somebody else, like package it up in an email, is actually useful for people who work on teams. In other words, if I'm working on a team and I'm going along and I see a bug, and it's not my bug, it's somebody else's, it's in a different part of the product, do I want to spend my time documenting that, or do I want to keep going? I want to keep going, right? So the shorter time it can take me to report that bug and get the needed information to somebody else, the better. So what I'm envisioning is a feature, and this may be a feature that we add to CodeRush in the future, or this might be something, who knows, that Visual Studio 10 or 11 or 12 comes out with, 2010 or beyond, the future version of Visual Studio comes out with. But the idea is the ability for me to be at a certain state inside of the IDE and basically take that state with all the debug windows that are appropriate and then just push that out to somebody else to investigate.
So, Mark, you're talking about some very specific enhancements that you guys can make to your products, and you're also have mentioned sort of the deplorable state of our industry's history with building user interfaces. Well, you know, I noticed that you're a big WPF guy. You guys are working in WPF and building control suites for WPF. Does WPF change the game? Is it just Windows Forms 4.0? And when are we going to stop seeing, you know, another carousel control?
That's great. Actually, I think you're going to see at least one more carousel control, at least I think. I probably should not say this, so let's just say this. Let's say you didn't hear this from me, okay? But I've heard discussion around the DevExpress offices of the creation of a carousel control that'll go out as a freebie that we'll release for free. And that's not – nobody's promising anything. You didn't hear that from me.
Does anybody actually use these things besides my mom?
Yeah, I don't know. The thing is the carousel has limited application, right? It really does not scale well at all.
Right.
If you got a few choices, that's good. But once you start throwing, you know, more choices than you can see on screen, you have some real scalability issues that are challenging. Unless, you know, like now, and I will say that like YouTube uses kind of a variation of the carousel in that it's got the you can kind of move left and right. You kind of see more options than are for videos than are on screen. At least, and I should clarify that one of the last times I checked YouTube, it had this, and it's not in their main one where they list two. It's in the scrolling one in the bottom that has the scrolling videos in terms of what you can see. But they use a variation of this, and it's okay if you don't need to see everything. Right, if you're just kind of browsing, like in the environment that they're using it in, hey, it's not so bad. You can just browse through a bunch, and it's useful from a screen real estate standpoint. It essentially fits more into a smaller space. I'm sorry, I was just gonna say it just doesn't scale well. And I'm aware that I still have another question you've asked me that I still have to answer. But go ahead and ask your next question, and I'll try and catch the last one and answer your next one too.
No, that's fine because it's probably one and the same. The question is, you know, is WPF really a game changer, or is that just another evolution of drag and drop UI? What is it, in your opinion?
That's the question that was on the queue, and it's up at the top of the stack now. Let's pop it out. And the answer is I think WPF it certainly facilitates a game change. It's kind of like a faster car that runs more efficiently you know, on gas. It takes a little bit more effort to drive. It's a little more complex, maybe necessarily. I guess it's a little more complex to drive, but as a result, you can have like awesome gas mileage, go super fast, and just have a great experience while you drive. So it's, you know, super pleasant, but it just takes a little bit more finesse. As the amount of finesse required drops, and as experience, you know, as the tools get better, and as people get more experienced with it, then yeah, it's pretty much going to change. I think it's going to change a lot. The reason why is because it allows you to do things with, well, there's actually a couple things, but one of the things is that it allows you to do things that were previously complex, like layout fairly simply. You also decoupling the design from the UI, I'm sorry, for the design from the source code, from the code, right? So the design of the UI from the source code, so that you can have like a designer working on the look of your application while you work on the source code. As a result, source code for controls and any kind of UI-related elements tends to start looking really simple. You don't have all this extra code that had to do with drawing and painting. It's all gone from the source code. And that's a nice thing. I also love the precision and the scalability of WPF as well. Those things are excellent. The fact that it's faster is also good. The fact that it has the ability to, you know, draw a lot, handle a lot of stuff on screen and do layout of a lot of stuff on screen faster than Windows Forms does, that's also good.
Are you noticing that?
I just got to bring a designer on board the team, though, and that's more expensive, right? And I got to do, and there's training and learning curve, and that's expensive. And the tools kind of aren't, they kind of suck right now. They're not perfect. And so they take, you know, it's this finesse that's required. So it's not quite a game changer yet because of the learning curve, because of the tools. But I think it will be. I think it's just going to just slowly move right into it. And before we know it, somebody will notice and say, hey, you know what? The game has changed. It's different now.
So now that we're not bound sort of in the typical squared window and we can do all sorts of new things, are you seeing new visual patterns of developers come out of this? I don't know if it's just WPF, but certainly the WPF world. So we talked about the carousel. Well, the carousel is a visual pattern, right? And there are other UI patterns that will become common. Developers will continue to reuse them. Have you seen anything really interesting that just makes a lot of sense that you can't pull off in a standard?
Well, I'll tell you, I guess I have two answers to that question. One is that one of the patterns is that I've noticed kind of a real general pattern, but this is in successful applications. And that pattern is that there is a designer involved and some thought applied to the user interface. That is, and it's a relatively unique user interface, but it works, right? There's enough in common with the old way of working. You know, focus is indicated in a way that is easy to spot. Buttons that can be clicked indicate that either by looking pliable, in other words, 3D, or by changing their contrast or some other image, for example, when you hover the mouse over them, changing their appearance when you hover the mouse. So one of the patterns there is the noticeable presence of a designer on board. The second pattern I've noticed is, and this is one I don't like, not so good, and that is of kind of a visual noise which is essentially something that distracts the eye and really shouldn't be there. And so as an example, I've seen this like, for example, a grid might have a header, and the header has got this gradient on it that kind of makes it look like it's kind of a super pliable, shiny button. Right? And it's the header for a grid. So, okay, I get it. Yeah, I can click on it. But it's because it's so shiny and the contrast is so high with the text, it really has a visual weight that's much greater than what it needs to be for communicating the fact that, hey, I can click on it and I'm holding data above it. So I see this tendency towards kind of an over graphic design on pieces where simply something more subtle makes a lot more sense, I think. The rule, one of the guiding rules I have is that the contrast of an item should correspond to the relevance of that information. So as an example in Excel, one of the examples I do in the Science of Great UI talk is like an inside. If you open up Excel and you look at the spreadsheet, the lines that separate the data, the lines that separate the cells, those lines, that's information, right? It is information, but it's low relevant information. Therefore, it's low contrast. Whereas the data itself defaults to black on white, which is, you know, high relevant information, the numbers, right? That's the high relevant, that's the information of high relevance in a spreadsheet. And so that contrast is going to be greater. And you can also couple that, and you can substitute, instead of using contrast, you can use the word size. So you can say size should match information relevance. So the larger something is, or that should imply the more relevant it is. And that kind of takes us back to the buttons when we were talking about the size of the buttons in the elevators, right? That lobby button, in my opinion, should be bigger than the rest of the button.
What a perfect completion of the circle.
There you go. The circle of programmer UI life, something like that.
What's a typical day like for Mark Miller?
Well, you know, it really changes from day to day. I'm kind of in a unique spot in my company where I kind of act as a liaison between folks at Microsoft who we have deals with for free versions of Factor, for example, and folks on the VB team or C++ or ASP.NET team, C# team. So sometimes I'm acting in that role as a liaison between our team and them. Sometimes I'm working between customers and my team. So, if customers are asking for a feature or something along those lines, or they're looking for clarification on something, sometimes I'll go out and I'll write like a technical blog post, or I'll answer tech support questions in the news groups. And sometimes I'll bring the right guys from our team to look at those issues. And sometimes I'm just working as a kind of a liaison between, I guess, my own vision for where I want us to be and where the team is now. So I'll be kind of talking to the team, about how to go between where we are and there. And then there's also outside of that, there's also, I'm starting to do more work with, our other products that we have. I'm starting to I've been going around telling everybody else, you know, how to do good design and stuff like that. And now people inside the company are figuring out that, you know what, it's really good to start applying these techniques to our controls and some of our other products, not just, you know, CodeRush or Factor. So I'm spending some of my time out there, and sometimes it's, you know, that's like a little bit of it. But in the mornings are usually reserved just talking with the guys on my team, and then usually in the afternoon I'm doing one of the appropriate things, you know, based on the demand.
You're really talking a lot about evangelist type of activities.
Right. And there's one other thing that I've been doing a lot of lately, and that is recording videos essentially training videos for our right now I'm focused on doing our refactoring. So I've recorded something like 80 different training videos that we're in the process of doing post-production on for our refactorings, and I'm probably just going to do more of that. We've got probably another 70 demos to record. And then branching out into other products. This video training is just part of that discoverability. One of the things we want to do, you know, we're talking about discoverability before. One of the things that we want to do, David, is we want to be able to go in the help, you know, be in the help somewhere, or maybe even in the product. Like say with the refactor product, you hit the refactor key, the menu comes up, and you see something like decompose initializer. And you see the big hint for it pop up next to it. It tells you what it's going to do, and you still don't understand it. It's still, you want to see more. And so there'll be a link on the bottom that says video demo, and you'll click that link, and you'll be able to go out and see the demo of that refactoring. And so that's like another aspect of discoverability that we're working to solve. We're moving closer to that. We think that's going to be cool. It's just like one part of the whole big puzzle of how do we get people to understand everything we built for them.
That's really great. Videos really are a great instructional medium, aren't they? So
yeah.
I'll ask you one more question. I know we said we're going to wrap up, but I do have, I feel compelled to ask you this, and I don't even mean to put you on the spot too much, but you know, I live in ReSharper pretty much every day, and I know a couple of other guys, who just love Code Rush and live in Code Rush. And so give me the elevator pitch. Why would I switch?
Well, I'm not sure if now is the right time to switch. I think it depends on what you need. There are a number of things that Code Rush and Refactor Pro do way better than ReSharper. Those include having many more refactorings, some super powerful refactorings, and also just a one-of-a-kind code templates, which are like code snippets on steroids. They're just super powerful, very efficient for writing code very fast. Those are the things that we do better than ReSharper. ReSharper, though, does something really, really well that we are playing catch-up on now. We don't have a shipping version of this yet. It's only in beta. And that is what we're calling this code issues, where you are told through highlighting and other indicators of areas of your code that can be fixed, improved, and then you have an easy way to fix those or improve those kinds of things. As a simple example, if I have a local variable of type brush and I initialize it, but I never call dispose on that local variable, that's an example of a local variable that could be disposed. And so we have a fix for that. We already have a refactoring for that, which is introduced a using statement on it. So that would then create a using statement, wrap the code in the using statement, and then you've got that guaranteed call to dispose at the end of that whole thing. What ReSharper spanked our butts in is essentially this thing I've been talking about, discoverability of features. Because ReSharper had this feature where they were saying, hey, here's the problem in your code, and oh, by the way, here's our fix, right? A lot of customers saw all the fixes, and they didn't see, you know, a lot of all the refactorings that we were shipping, right? So this is an area that we are catching up with. Right now we're shipping this as a beta. So if you get like a current build, you can turn this beta feature on, this code issues, and see these issues where in the code highlighted, just like you see in ReSharper. The only other thing that ReSharper has right now that we do not have is their test case runner. So if you're in love with the test case runner, we don't have that as a feature yet in the product. It is something that's on our list. We do have one guy on the team who's very enthusiastic about bringing that and shipping that, but it is not shipping it yet at this time. One other thing, if I can make the pitch for this, that I
would. Yeah,
please. There's one other really cool thing I'm really excited about right now, David, which is the it's a new refactoring that we are shipping in that's going to be shipping in the next version of Refactor Pro. This refactoring is actually available right now if you get a daily build from support. If you're a customer, if you're a Refactor Pro customer or Code Rush customer, you can get a daily build with this refactoring, and it is called Extract Method to Type. And it solves the problem of having code that is really in the wrong type. You've probably seen it where it's code that works on locals of another type that you have somewhere declared in the solution. And you
helper
see that
methods.
Block. Of, what did you say?
Helper methods.
Exactly. So you've got helper methods, right? And that, what do the helper methods do? They take as a parameter maybe, you know, an instance of that type, right? And then they do a bunch of stuff on that instance. Well, all of that needs to essentially go, or at least some block of it needs to go in that type that you've got in your solution. And what it can do is it can take that block of code and analyze it for all the different local possibilities of which you have source code to in your solution, and then give you a menu or submenus that say extract method to type, and it would list the type out. So, for example, if I had a person class, let's say I had a method, a helper method, that took two persons, and added each person to each other's contact list, like I was doing like a Facebook kind of friend connection thing, right? So I would, you know, one line of code might be person1.contacts.add and person two, passing that in. And then the other one would be like the opposite of that. So a simple example, right? I could take that block of code and say extract method to person. and then I would see two submenu items. It would allow me to have either person one be the calling point or person two being the calling point. And then what that method would then consist of something that said in one of them would be replaced with the, one of the references to person or person two would be replaced with the this keyword, or if you're in VB, the me keyword. And the other one would simply be a parameter into the method. But everything's updated. All the calling sites updated, and the code that you move across is updated. So I really, really like this refactoring because it does a lot of work, and it solves a problem that normally would take a lot of tedious work to solve.
But the way you described it, that really is going to enforce separation of concerns better and just flat out make better code.
It does. Now, the only thing that's missing is the discoverability on it, right? The ability for us to detect great candidates for extraction. And that is on our list, but it's not shipping yet, right? Right now, it requires the guru or the expert or the programmer looking at it to identify it and realize, oh, this is in the wrong spot. It's a helper method. The body of this needs to move somewhere else.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I always learn something when I talk to you. I like that.
All right. Well, you guys are welcome. Thanks, David. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Elegant Codecast, and we really appreciate your listening. We look forward to bringing you even more diverse subjects in technology and software development. If you have any suggestions for the show or would like more information on something you heard in this episode, please contact us at codecast@elegantcode.com.